Can you imagine the kind of letter you would write to your great-great-grandkids? 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
Do you really live in a thing not much bigger than a couple of our phone boxes?
Perhaps you just press a button or twiddle a knob on some time machine and pop in to any point in time and space you feel inclined to visit.
Clearly they got a lot wrong. So why are we so bad at predicting the future? I'm Matt Bevan, and for If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the unpredictable moments that change the course of history.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The man at the centre of today's episode has a lot of folklore associated with him. Magical healing powers and apparent invincibility, as if he was playing life on easy mode. And an alluring presence that many found hard to resist. But perhaps the most interesting myth about the man, or puerile depending on your perspective, is that he was incredibly well endowed. So much so that rumour has it, after death, his genitals were preserved in a jar and put on display in a museum. December 1916. It's winter in Russia in the middle of World War I. Pretty bleak, but not tonight. Prince Felix Yusupov of the noble House of Yusupov is throwing a party at his palace. Yusupov is the nephew-in-law of Russia's big dog, Tsar Nicholas II, the head of state. A handsome aristocrat from one of Russia's wealthiest families, the young prince married into the royal family just 3 years earlier. And the invite list to his get-together reads like a who's who of Russian nobility. This is a collection of men all cut from the same cloth. They match the palace's opulence to a T. Except for one man, who stands out from the crowd both literally and figuratively. He's tall and broad-shouldered, a long beard, long hair, and wild eyes. This is the Siberian peasant turned faith healer, Rasputin. Yusupov and his royal cronies have lured the mystic monk here tonight on the pretense of a party. But this is no party. This is a trap. And maybe if Rasputin had have paid closer attention to the guest list, he'd have wisened up to the threat. Among the attendees is Vladimir Purishkevich, a popular politician, monarchist, and right-wing extremist, known for his anti-communist and anti-Semitic views. Just a month earlier, Purishkevich had given a speech in the Duma, the Russian Assembly, denouncing Rasputin's influence over the monarchy and calling for his death. The kind of speech that should have given Rasputin pause before accepting the invitation to the palace. In fact, Rasputin's own allies had warned him to lay low, that there were plots forming against him. But Rasputin doesn't seem too concerned. He's drinking wine and eating pastries with the other guests, seemingly oblivious to any tension. And maybe he's right to feel this way. You see, Rasputin has had a kind of immunity in these circles, a specific kind of power that makes him almost untouchable. The favour of the Tsar and Tsarina. Yusupov steers the party to his wine cellar. Rasputin, a famously heavy drinker, downs more and more wine, getting drunker and drunker. In between glasses, he scoffs the delicious pastries. Yusupov and his cronies are perplexed. The cyanide they laced Rasputin's food and drink with is having no effect at all. Not only is he still standing, he's still drinking, downing yet another glass of poison-laced wine. He's had enough cyanide to floor a bear. It's 2:30 a.m. How is he still standing? Frustrated and fresh out of cyanide, Yusupov smuggles a revolver into the cellar. It's time to put an end to this once and for all. The prince shoots Rasputin in the heart, and the giant mystic crumples in a heap. The partygoers are keen to cover their tracks, so one dons Rasputin's coat and hat, and they drive to his apartment to make it look like he returned home that night. Mission accomplished. They return to the palace to take care of the body. But as Yusupov approaches the corpse, something unimaginable. Did Rasputin's eyelid just flutter? Suddenly, both eyes fly open. The undead Rasputin is awake and furious. With a roar, he jumps up and grabs Yusupov. The prince wriggles free and runs upstairs. Rasputin gives chase, and the pair end up in the palace's courtyard. There, Purishkevich, that politician who called for Rasputin's death in the Russian assembly, raises a pistol and shoots the mystic monk twice. The partygoers are petrified, believing that the powers of Satan brought Rasputin back from the dead. They bind his body, drive it to a nearby bridge, and throw it into the frozen depths of Little Nievka River. Hello, my friend. I'm Aslan Pahari, and this is Assassins, the show where we tell the stories of history's most shocking assassinations. And today, it's the story of Russia's OG influencer, in the literal sense, Rasputin. How did a Siberian peasant end up holding sway in the halls of power? What was he after? And how did this mystic monk meet his end, leaving Russia's last royal dynasty, the Romanovs, crumbling in his wake? Also, what's the deal with all those rumors about his genitals? Don't worry, I won't forget about the phallus in a jar. Rasputin may have been subjected to a bit of slut-shaming in his time, but could he have been a catalyst for revolution? Rasputin was born in 1869 in a small village in western Siberia. And nothing out of the ordinary seems to happen to Rasputin until, in his late 20s, he embarks on a long pilgrimage to a monastery. He returns a changed man, refusing to groom himself, maintaining a disheveled, even dirty air. Rasputin becomes a kind of wandering ascetic, heading off on more and more pilgrimages, traveling as far as Greece and the Middle East to visit holy sites and meet with the devout. In the early 1900s, Rasputin made his way to St. Petersburg, the seat of power in Russia at the time. Mystical powers aside, Rasputin showed a deft ability for social climbing, quickly rising the ranks of Russian high society. And in late 1905, Rasputin met Tsar Nicholas II and Tsarina Alexandra. Rasputin's arrival in St. Petersburg coincided with a growing fascination for alternative religions and the occult amongst the Russian nobility. Tsarina Alexandra had long been intrigued by mysticism and made a habit of meeting with wandering holy men to seek their guidance. Rasputin exploded onto the scene. His eclectic beliefs, mixed with some apparent medical know-how, meant that soon he was the nobility's shiny new toy. And honestly, he didn't mind, like at all. As a mystic, he preached all kinds of superstitions that didn't fit neatly into one religion. For example, he preached that physical contact with his body had the power to purify people. Whatever that means. Unsurprisingly, the religious orthodoxy condemned him as a charlatan. But the women of St. Petersburg seemed less concerned with the validity of his claims, and Rasputin quickly gained a reputation for being something of a ladies' man. The Tsar and Tsarina became convinced that only Rasputin could heal their son's hemophilia. On more than one occasion, Rasputin stemmed the boy's bleeding with his medical know-how and became a calming, soothing influence on the boy. Alexandra believed that Rasputin possessed amazing healing and spiritual powers, and he was the key to keeping their only son, the heir to the throne, alive. In a matter of years, Rasputin went from consulting with the Empress on matters of her son's health to advising her on matters of the royal court. By the time World War I kicked off in 1914, Rasputin was well and truly entrenched in the Russian royal court. So, when the Tsar decided to go to the front line against the Germans, he seemed glad that someone like Rasputin could ease his wife's worries while he was gone. But the Tsar had no idea how precarious his grip on power was. The Romanovs had been Russia's ruling dynasty for around 300 years, but over time, they'd lost touch with reality, and the people had noticed. Now, the Tsar wasn't totally unaware. He used brute force to quell the 1905 revolution, but it was as if that experience taught him nothing. Instead of shining a light on his country's disadvantaged masses, he went off to lead the army in World War I. And with the Tsar off trying to win a war, his kingdom was restless. This restlessness was compounded by Russia's failures on the front line. The Tsar was quickly developing a reputation for being a hapless, inexperienced leader, completely out of his depth in wartime. Back home in St. Petersburg, the Tsarina was increasingly enthralled with Rasputin. The mystic monk could do no wrong and took full advantage of the situation. Rasputin was betting women left, right, and center and drinking heavily. And in his drunken stupors, regaling anyone who'd listen with tales of his sexual exploits and the influence he held at the palace. The Tsarina herself was increasingly unpopular, a German ruling over Russia at a time when the two countries were at war. She made little effort to win over the Russian people and was frequently tongue-tied in public. Many believed her to have a cold demeanor. And so, as she grew closer and closer to this peasant mystic, their relationship was not viewed with generosity. The nobility, too, began questioning Rasputin's influence on the royal court. Who was he anyway? He wasn't ordained. He wasn't a learned man or of noble blood. What was he even doing in the halls of power? At the top of the Russian hierarchy sat a weak ruler, a superstitious empress, and a disheveled faith healer. It's no wonder the Russian people were fast losing faith in the divine rule of the Romanovs. Another revolution was simmering under the surface. Now, to us, the idea of a mystic monk holding sway at the pinnacle of Russian society might seem wild or absurd. But mystics were a somewhat common feature at this time. All over Europe, mystics and miracle workers were hugely popular. Indeed, before Rasputin, the Tsarina had another favoured mystic, a Frenchman called Dr. Philippe. But what set Rasputin apart was the overwhelmingly positive impact he had on the Tsar and Tsarina's son, Alexei. No matter how much Rasputin drank, cavorted, or even abused his followers, the queen wouldn't hear a bad word about him. When two governesses raised objections to Rasputin having free access to their young daughters' rooms, they were let go. When women claimed he had raped or behaved inappropriately with them, they were disbelieved. The Tsarina genuinely believed that Rasputin was a holy man and was above such indiscretions. But even she had her breaking point. Towards the end of Rasputin's time in the royal court, the rumours got too much, even for the Tsarina, and she sent Rasputin back to his village. But when her son's health took a turn for the worse, the Tsarina immediately recalled him. And Rasputin's reputation continued to grow. Rumours were churned out at breakneck speed. Rasputin was sleeping with the Tsarina, his legion of female followers, and ladies of the nobility. The mystic monk indulging in raucous orgies at a time when the Russian Empire was facing incredible challenges abroad. Cartoons showed him with the Tsar and Tsarina on his lap, letting him rule by proxy. You can see why men of the Russian nobility might not have been Rasputin's biggest fans. He had become a spectacle, and the ruling class was getting fed up. It was against this backdrop of animosity and outrage that Prince Yusupov invited Rasputin to a party at his palace. A few days after Rasputin's body was thrown off the bridge, it was discovered frozen in the river. Finally, mercifully dead. Prince Yusupov later wrote, "There was something appalling and monstrous in his diabolical refusal to die." Well, at least this is the popular account of Rasputin's death. But this account is from the memoir of Prince Yusupov. It's not the result of an objective investigation. And the more you read about this account, the more it becomes clear that the story has been embellished, if not completely fabricated. Historians agree that little about his recall of events is factual. Rather, it seems to have been a way for the prince to make money from his killing of the monk. So, what do we know about his actual factual death? Well, the real story, or the provable story, is much less exciting. A single post-mortem photo turned up 2 months after Rasputin's death. In it, a gunshot wound is visible in the middle of his forehead with what looks to be a contact mark from the muzzle, meaning he was shot in the head at point-blank range. No poison was found in his blood during the autopsy, nor were there any indications of drowning. He did have bullet wounds to his liver and kidneys, which over time would have been fatal. But a gunshot straight to the center of the forehead? Well, experts are pretty confident that was the cause of death. The public reaction to Rasputin's killing was largely positive. Many were relieved that the royal family was finally rid of this peasant who brought disrepute to the House of Romanov. Others were glad that this debauched fraud of a man was finally put down. But many commoners were outraged. They saw Rasputin as one of them, a common man who had managed to rise above his station. Other commoners were also outraged, but only because the nobles killed him. They saw Rasputin as a sign of rot in the dynasty, sure, but they also saw his death as a convenient way for nobles to pin the blame for all their problems on the only commoner around. The assassins went largely unpunished. The prince and the Grand Duke were placed under house arrest for some time, and then Yusupov was exiled back to his family's estate. A slap on the wrist, if that. The Tsar was already under pressure over his horny monk. He didn't want to cause further unrest by coming down on those who got rid of him. The murderers were also members of his extended family. Prince Yusupov, riding high on public contempt for Rasputin, branded himself as a patriot, a man who shot the mad monk for the good of his country. And his pivot worked. He wrote two best-selling books about the ordeal. A matter of weeks after Rasputin's assassination, the February Revolution erupts. With the Tsar's failures in the war, the Tsarina's failures on the home front, and mass food shortages all hitting at once, the revolutionaries forced the Tsar's abdication. The Romanov dynasty is over. Later that year, Lenin's Bolsheviks seize power in the October Revolution, and in 1918, the last royal Romanovs, Tsar Nicholas II, Tsarina Alexandra, and their son, are all shot dead in a basement. Oh, that's right, the question of his genitals. How could I forget? Now, there aren't many reliable sources that cover the myths, rumours, and lies about the man who courted the Romanovs, some of which he seemed to have begun himself, so it's difficult to piece together the full truth. But even in death, the salacious rumours about Rasputin continued to spread. And they don't stop at tales of his exploits or pornographic cartoons. To this day, there are whispers that this man's actual disembodied phallus is still out there somewhere, preserved for future generations. And if you believe the rumors, it was massive. Nobody at the time could understand how this unkempt, dirty man could possibly seduce all these hordes of women. Noble ladies, prostitutes, servants, followers, he bedded them all. So clearly, the secret must have been in his trousers. The myth that Rasputin was well endowed first emerged in the 1920s, when rumors spread that a group of Russian women in Paris had possession of the severed member and believed that it had healing powers. So the story goes, Rasputin's daughter Maria heard these rumors and demanded it back, keeping it from the public until her death in California in 1977. Now, we don't know if that's true or not, but what we do know is that in 1994, a man called Michael Augustine came across a penis in a pickle jar from a storage locker that belonged to Maria before her death. Michael had the penis tested, and it turned out it was a large pickled sea cucumber. The Museum of Russian Erotica in St. Petersburg claims to have the real Rasputin penis, once again preserved in a jar. The museum's owner has neglected to get the foot-long phallus tested to confirm its origin story. Some zoologists theorize it actually comes from a horse or a bull. All that being said, Rasputin's wife is on record responding to the rumors of his infidelities, saying, "He has enough for all," and that's probably enough for all of us. Assassins is hosted by me, Aslan Pahari. Hannah Jose is the producer. Sound by John Jacobs. Executive producers are Joel Werner, Eric George, and Jessica Radburn. As well as listening to Assassins, you can watch full episodes of the show on YouTube and Spotify. Those videos are shot and edited by Tejas Bhatt. If there's an assassination you think we should cover on the show, please email us, assassins@abc.net.au. I hope to hear from you soon, my friend.